And now, more NATO troops for Afghanistan and a commitment to keep U.S. troops in Iraq. These are the two themes President Bush is sounding at the NATO summit in Riga, Latvia today. The president spoke at Latvia University, where he told the leaders of the 25 other NATO member countries that he plans to keep U.S. troops in Iraq until that country is stabilized. The president also said that success in Afghanistan, where 33,000 NATO troops are facing a renewed Taliban insurgency, is key to the war on terror.
Today, Afghanistan is NATO's most important military operation. And by standing together in Afghanistan, we'll protect our people, defend our freedom, and send a clear message to the extremists. The forces of freedom and decency will prevail.
Time Magazine Washington correspondent Mike Allen is traveling with the president. He joins us on the line from Riga. And Mike, we know the president has said he wants a renewed commitment from NATO countries to fight this renewed Taliban in Afghanistan. Right now, only the U.S., Britain, Canada, and the Netherlands are said to be doing the heavy lifting. What is the president asking for?
Well, Robin, this could be a test of how much muscle the president still has with some of these countries. When it came to NATO, the U.S. used to get whatever it wanted. But here, mainly because of a disagreement about Iraq, and this will also be looked at through the lens of whether there's been some diminishment of the president's authority because of what happened domestically. But he is pushing countries besides the one that you mentioned to do more. The administration isn't naming names publicly. They're trying to say it positively, talking about some of the countries that you just mentioned. What they're saying is those countries are fighting above their weight, doing more than their share of the Afghanistan force in NATO force in Afghanistan.
Because they're primarily in the south where the fiercest fighting is, and the other countries, the unnamed countries, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, are in the north where it's more secure. What's the reaction been to the idea that they might send more troops into, you know, more harm's way?
Well, what you heard today was NATO officials saying today that this needed to be phased out by 2008, just the sort of like specific timetable the president doesn't like, but also certainly that NATO would not still need to be working at this strength at this time. This is just another example of how much the president's goals and timetables have slipped.
Well, this is all taking place as we look ahead to later in the week when the president is going to be meeting with the Iraq Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, in Jordan. That's on Thursday. Once again today, the president said the U.S. will stay in Iraq until that country is stabilized. Just give us your quick thought as to what the president has to do come Thursday.
The president's main mission is to show that he is on top of Iraq and that he is working to do whatever that can be done. Robin, I think there was a time when the White House was eager to embrace the recommendations that will come out, we're still here in December, from Secretary James Baker's Iraq Study Group. They were, you could call it political cover, you could call it a political stalking horse, but they would put the idea out there and the White House would embrace it. That's why they've been telling us they hope they would be specific and not just put out some options. But Robin, I think all this coverage about how this White House was being rescued by the father's aides started to get under their skin a little bit, and they've made several pretty pointed, frank comments, making it clear that the president is the person who's going to make these decisions.
Well, just one quick question. We understand the president was asked today about NBC's decision to refer to the conflict in Iraq officially as a civil war. What did he say in response?
Well, he basically didn't engage. He didn't say it wasn't. He didn't say it was. He said there's all kinds of speculation about what might be happening. Robin, for obvious reasons, this White House doesn't want to use that term. Various officials, including Tony Snow, the press secretary, have pushed back against the use of it. But it's obvious that it's going to become more widely used by various news organizations, and I don't think they want to look like they're, as Bob Woodward's title put it, a state of denial. So you won't see them using it themselves, but I think they're looking for ways out of it. And the president didn't pin himself into the corner of directly saying that there wasn't one.
Mike Allen, Time Magazine Washington correspondent. To read his travelogue on the president's trip, by the way, go to our website, here-now.org. Mike, thanks so much.
Robin, have a beautiful week.
Philadelphia-based retailer Urban Outfitters is being criticized by community activists for selling a small, glittery gun as a Christmas tree ornament. Gun violence in Philadelphia has been a growing problem for months now. We want to spend a few minutes on that today, including an update on a story about a special van for kids paralyzed by gun violence. But first, Philadelphia's homicide rate so far this year is 370. That's compared with 338 for the same period last year. Most of those murders were committed using handguns. In the past week, five more people were shot and injured by guns. Yesterday, community activists protested at Urban Outfitters, and joining us is one of them. Malik Aziz is director of Philadelphia's program that helps convicted criminals leave prison and return to the community. He's also co-founder of the group Men United for a Better Philadelphia. We reached him working on the street on his cell phone. Malik, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit first about Men United. We know you walk the streets of Philadelphia talking to people. Who are you looking for and what are you saying?
What we do, we go to the affected areas that statistics say where most of the homicides and shootings are being done. And what we do is what we call a street outreach to young people just standing around on corners, door-to-door knocking. And we pass out some literature, and we talk about gun violence, and we talk about alternatives to violence and things of that nature.
Yeah. For instance, where are you right now?
Actually, I'm in West Philadelphia, where there's been some shootings, and I had a conversation with some of the young people in the playground who say that they are not part of the shootings, but they're afraid of being victims of gunfire in their neighborhoods, and by the time it gets dark, they will be in the house.
Yeah. You say, I've read members of your group also quoted as saying, you know, you talk to parents and ask them to take responsibility, do gun searches?
Yes. We ask the parents to be more involved in their children's lives while they're in school. While they're in school, some parents are afraid to confront their children when they're home. Just take a quick look through their bedroom and through where they frequent in the house, see if they have any weapons, especially firearms.
Yeah. What do you think of what we're hearing a lot of Philadelphia residents are asking for, which is more police involvement and especially frisking? We're hearing that people are saying they want more, you know, people stopped and frisked. They don't mind that. In fact, I was reading one resident say they want checkpoints set up. What do you think about frisking more people to find more guns?
Well, I think that in our city we have a police commissioner who says he will not break the law to enforce the law.
Right.
And because of people's civil rights and because of people's rights just to be able to walk down the street without being under suspicion of having a gun, I think that would be a real drastic initiative to undertake. Even though the issue of gun violence is at a heightened sensitivity in our community, that we have to realize that we have to be more responsible for our own homes where our children and people that live in our homes are participating in illegal activity for using illegal guns.
Well, we understand that this stop and frisk program was attempted in 1985 in Philadelphia, but there were a lot of civil rights suits. And, you know, other cities have tried it, and when they've trained police to make sure they have probable cause before stopping someone, in other words, if someone looks like they're hiding a weapon, it has worked.
All right. Well, they have made some seizures here where the police have acted on suspicion, and they come up, quite frankly, they came up with the gun as well as other illegal substance and around drugs and money. But who would you stop to think if they have a gun? Would it be profiling and things of that nature? So I think our community is at a point now where anything that would help with the violence being stemmed would be welcome. And I think that we have to be smart and not infringing on people's rights and still be real, real, real strong on police presence and also community-based organizations working together to eradicate violence in our city.
You know, you mentioned the profiling, and we're reminded of the case in New York right now where the police are facing allegations of excessive force, charges of profiling after gunning down the apparently unarmed young club goer, a young African American, a male who, you know, had gone out the night before his wedding. And I'm wondering too about the illegal guns and the growing assumption, you know, that at 4 o'clock in the morning, a young African male is going to have one. I mean, we don't really know what happened there yet. There's going to be an investigation, but Do you tell your young kids that as well, that, you know, you don't want it to be assumed you have a gun?
When I do my school presentations, these are one of the things that I talk about. It is perceived in our community that our children, when they're dressed with a hoodie covering their head, when they're wearing their pants down around their, almost around their ankles, and they're wearing the big clothes that obviously don't fit them, they're too big, but that's the dress code in the inner city, that they're a criminal. So my when I speak to in schools, I speak to about having an accurate dress code of dress to impress, a dress for success, and not to be profiled because of your dress. It's just the way things are. Crime is intensified so much in our community now that our senior citizens and people who are homeowners that have a lot at stake in their community are just crying out for solution. And in crying out for solution, they're asking for more police presence, and they're asking for more arrests. Not knowing on the flip side of that it's going to bring some things into the community that it's going to remove our young people from the community because of the way they dress, and it's going to have the police stop them.
Right, and perhaps lead to the kind of tragedy we saw in New York. It's such a tough one. Malik, I'm looking at this number. I mean, that's literally a person a day shot and killed in your neighborhoods. And I'm reading of Philadelphia residents, one who knows of 20 homicides within a half mile of her home.
Right, and that's horrendous. Mm. That's horrendous, and this is not a declared war zone. And that's like Iraq or Afghanistan, but we're getting numbers similar to those numbers. And not just this year, but years previously, it looks like that we might surpass this year. We had 383 homicides last year. Before the new year came in, we're at right now on this day, as we're speaking, at 370. Mm. So it's statistically, realistically to say, God forbid if we do, but statistically, we're looking at going over 400 homicides. With 2006.
Why do kids feel they need guns?
There's a lot of factors, and you know, you get the social people, the economic people. They have their opinion on why things are violence is increasing in our city because of no jobs, the lack of education, opportunities, all kinds of things to add up to that. But in my opinion, the kids they don't have nothing to do. They see the violence on the TV. They play the video games. They listen to the rap music. And all that combined, it just brings out the worst in them. You know, you're at a heightened alert anyway, and so these young people, they don't want to get hurt. If they get hurt, they're going to respond back with a gun. Not even considering the consequences that they could get the death penalty or they could get life in prison without no parole, they still put the gun in it when they waistband and go out and look for the person, and when they see them, they shoot them.
Malik Aziz, he's co-founder of the group Men United for a Better Philadelphia, adults trying to get kids there to give up guns. He'll be back with us right after just a minute break, and we'll explain how he feels the gun laws in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania are also not on his side in his effort. We're also going to hear from two mothers whose kids were paralyzed by gunfire. They're sharing, maybe more than pain, sharing a special van. That's ahead, here and now. And now back with Malik Aziz, director of the City of Philadelphia's program that helps convicted criminals reintegrate into their community. But he's also co-founder of the group Men United for a Better Philadelphia. Now, in a moment, we're going to speak with a Philadelphia mother who lost her son to gun violence there, and she's donating his wheelchair-equipped van to a mother here in Boston whose child was also paralyzed by gunfire. And Malik, you were saying the homicide rate in the city might go over 400 this year. Where do these guns come from?
We have so many guns in our community. A lot of people are straw purchasing guns. When they take a person to a gun show, they will ask the person that has the clear record to buy the guns. Because in Pennsylvania, you don't have to report where the guns go. Hmm. It's a crazy thing. You could buy as many guns as you want, but if you lose them, you don't have to report them. You could actually literally say that when I was coming down the turnpike, box of guns fell off and they disappeared.
You spent time in prison yourself. You spent time in a gang. Is there a key that unlocked your life that you can share with other kids, or is the time too different?
Well, these kids today will tell you that the time is different. and they appreciate the story, the war story you'll tell them about when you was doing something. But they'll say, you got too old, or you're scared down, and, you know, what are your motives? Why are you telling me to stop doing this? What are you hating on me? I mean, these are all the kind of phrases these young people, they use. But when you get some young people who have been directly affected by gun violence, it's easier to talk to them, or some young people that have already been incarcerated because of selling drugs or haven't been involved with a gun crime, it's more easier to address them about their immediate needs and things that are going to affect them and the consequences they're going to face if they stay involved in that lifestyle.
Do you think there's something about Philadelphia that's making the situation tougher? I mean, you mentioned the gun laws. Other cities have gotten guns off the street through different programs, Stop and Frisk being one. Do you think there's something different about guns in Philadelphia?
Well, I think the availability of guns is a problem. We have in Philadelphia right now over 30,000 people that legally have license to carry a concealed weapon. I think that's a problem. I think that if you go in a gun shop right now, you can buy as many guns as you want, handguns. Why do we need so many handguns? We have legislation in Harrisburg where you could buy one gun a month. That's 12 guns a year. That's more than enough guns in your house. But the majority of the legislature is not in favor of the one gun a month.
Right, they shut that
down.
So
it went down in defeat.
Yeah. Malik Aziz, director of the City of Philadelphia's program to help ex-prisoners return to the community, but also co-founder of the group Men United for a Better Philadelphia. Malik, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Anytime you need me, just feel free to call.
Well, you may recall that we recently spoke with a mother in Philadelphia who had just lost her son to gun violence. When Janice Jackson Burke's son Kevin was 20, he was shot and paralyzed by some teenagers after he refused to give up his Allen Iverson basketball jersey. He spent the last 3 years on a ventilator, but then it failed and he was buried last week. When we were talking to his mom about his life, we also asked if she was aware of a little girl in our area in Boston who'd also been paralyzed by a bullet. This was her response.
Does she have a van? Because I have a van, nice van out here, a corrosion van that has a ramp and everything, TV. It's really nice. It was given to me from a mother that lost her son. So if she needs a van, you know, let her know.
Well, we did. And joining us on the line from Boston is Tanya David, whose daughter Kylie Harriet was paralyzed by a stray bullet in 2003 when she was just three. Kylie's now six. Tanya, hello.
Hello.
And I don't know if you could hear that there, but our listeners, we heard from so many people. I'm looking at an email from Corey McNeil in Downington, Pennsylvania, we were just stunned at how quickly Janice's first thought was, does she have a van? You don't have a van?
We do not have a van. We were on public transportation, and we had to do that for the past year and a half.
Public transportation, you mean like the T here, the subway here, taxis and things with a wheelchair?
Yes, we were, and we made the best of it, and we knew that it was temporary. I was trying to save for a vehicle, and by this great blessing that God bestowed, here comes Janice Burke with an opportunity to make our winter dream come true.
Well, in fact, I think we have Janice Jackson Burke with us. Janice, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, Janice. Janice, I know you and Tanya, there have been a flurry of phone calls back and forth, but we have Tanya on the line as well. Okay. And so the van is going to go to Tanya.
Yes, it will.
Well, I tell you, you know, people responded. So your very first thought when I mentioned Tanya was that van. How important was that van to you, and why did it come to you so quickly? Why did you think of that van so quickly?
I tried for over a year and a half to get a van, either to purchase one or for someone to donate one to me. So that was my first thought when my son had passed. You know, when I came home from the hospital and I seen the van, I said, we have to get rid of the van and give it to someone that needs it.
Janice, I'm thinking that it seems particularly appropriate that this van go to Kylie. Your son, Janice, was incredibly forgiving of the boys who shot him. He dedicated his short life to speaking to other kids about violence and to helping you with forgiveness. We spoke about this. But Tanya's daughter, Kylie, Tanya, your daughter, you know, brought Boston to its knees when she publicly forgave her shooter.
Yeah, she did. It's important to show people that when you forgive from your heart, you release a freedom within yourself to go forward and live your life in peace. When I heard about this and thinking that this woman, you know, had considered us right off the bat, and I just feel blessed that out of so many people, who else could use this vehicle, because they are hard to get. So again, thank you.
That's Tanya David of Boston. Her now 6-year-old daughter, Kylie, is in a wheelchair because of a stray bullet that hit her when she was 3. We're also speaking to Janice Jackson Burke of Philadelphia. She's donating her late son Kevin's van to Tanya and Kylie. Janice, Tanya, thanks so much and best to you.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
More ahead, here and now. Funding for now. There's a buzz gathering about an omission on Atlantic Monthly's list of the top 100 Americans of all time. Missing from the list, President John F. Kennedy. Worse still to his fans, every president from 1933 to 1974 except Kennedy makes the cut. The magazine asked 10 historians to compile lists and from them produced an overall top 100. It appears in the December issue of the magazine. Ellen Fitzpatrick is a historian at the University of New Hampshire. She was one of the historians asked to come up with a list. And Ellen, you were only one of two who included JFK on the list. Why do you think more didn't?
Historians are very much influenced, as are all other Americans, by the present. And several things have diminished Kennedy's significance, I think, to historians. The first has to do with the fact that his presidency was so short. He was only in office 1,000 days, and much of what he hoped to accomplish was actually accomplished by his successor, Lyndon Johnson. The second factor that has influenced his historical standing is the post-Watergate, post-Vietnam mood in which most of the recent presidents have been tarnished by the muckraking journalism and the skepticism with which many Americans view the presidency today and those who have held the office. And those, I think, have been very significant factors. The final issue that has affected his standing is the fate of the kind of liberalism that he represented. When you think that conservatives often refer to radical liberals, there was a time when liberalism of the kind that Kennedy exemplified in his leadership really represented a kind of high watermark of optimism and idealism, and that is a very distant moment in American political history.
But it led to civil rights and women's rights and all sorts of rights.
It was part of that, and those who are liberals remember and celebrate those facts. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on one's political sensibilities, liberalism, that period of American liberalism, has been eclipsed by the disappointments that has followed and by the movement of the political spectrum towards the right.
Right. Well, there you go. John F. Kennedy not on the list, even though, you know, his supporters would say once we knew exactly what went on during the Cuban Missile Crisis, for instance, that he showed tremendous leadership.
He absolutely deserves to be on the list, in my view, and I put him on there. I think he's an extremely important figure in his own right, but also in his impact on an entire generation, on the whole post-World War II period.
Right. Well, this could lead to another special, when historians fight.
They often do.
Right, right. Which is, well, and we know that because history, views of history change over time. But let's move on to some of the other names that were on the list that seem cemented in their positions. For instance, Abraham Lincoln tops the list at number one, saved the Union, freed the slaves. That seems as if there'd be no argument.
It was very easy to arrive at Abe Lincoln as number one on the list. I put him number one on mine.
In fact, you say that the first third or so, maybe even first half of the list, historians are all in agreement about. Let's tick through some. Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin. It goes down to John D. Rockefeller, man behind Standard Oil, making money, giving it away, Henry Ford, the assembly line in the Model T, love affair with the automobile. Ronald Reagan at 17.
Not in my list. I hasten to add. I think that Reagan is a very important figure. I had him at 36. I had him behind JFK, who I had at 35. By the way, the rank ordering is absurd. I mean, history doesn't work that way. All of these figures interact with their historical moment. Right. There's no grand rank order in history. But for the purposes of this exercise, it was fun to think about. Right. Reagan is given credit for ending the Cold War. I would put much greater emphasis on the collapse of the Soviet Union of its own, you know.
Under its own weight.
Yeah.
We understand that that's the debate among historians. Did he, did Reagan build up an arms deficit in the U.S. for naught because the Soviet Union was going to collapse anyway?
I think Reagan is not somebody who I see as deserving of the position that he occupies in the final list.
And
important, yes, but not necessarily for the reasons that The Atlantic is describing.
And will they also add, he's also the amiable architect of the conservative realignment. And
well, that is his, I think, central significance to the political history of recent decades.
You see, as controversial as some of the, you know, the top half might be, the bottom half gets really funny when
very murky.
Historians. Why?
Part of the bias is built into the selection of historians, many of whom are political historians. I'm actually a political and an intellectual historian, so I had several intellectuals or cultural figures on the list who never made it.
Well, like which,
for instance,
like
P.T. Barnum is on their list, wasn't on mine, but I had Emily Dickinson on my list. I had Franz Boas, who was the founder of cultural anthropology, had enormous impact on our understanding of race. I thought that he deserved a place there.
Yeah, but you're fighting against P.T. Barnum.
Yes, and P.T. Barnum was a notable figure. I had William F. Buckley Jr., who I think is extremely important as an intellectual force in shaping American conservatism. Frederick Jackson Turner, a historian who really crafted a theory that argued that all of American society devolved from the frontier experience.
Well, let's look at some of the others that did make it. At 83, again, numbers don't mean anything, but at 83, James Fenimore Cooper, I love the line, the novels are unreadable, but he was the first great mythologizer of the frontier.
I didn't put him on my list, but I did put Louisa May Alcott on my list because of her importance on children's literature.
Uh-huh. Richard Nixon at 99 broke the New Deal majority, then broke his presidency. Herman Melville at 100. Moby Dick was a flop at the time, but he's remembered as the American Shakespeare. What are some others that jump out at you?
On their list or mine?
A little of both.
Okay. One thing that I find quite notable is that there were no Native Americans on the list that emerged in The Atlantic.
Who would you have put?
I put on my list Tecumseh. I put Geronimo. I think it would be arguable whether Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, some of the great Indian warriors and statesmen belonged, I think, on the list. Mm-hmm. I also know Rosa Parks did not make the list. Langston Hughes didn't make the list. Right. Bob Dylan isn't on the list.
But Bill Gates is. So is Rachel Carson, Margaret Sanger, the champion of birth control.
One person that I thought of was Eugene V. Debs, who was an extraordinarily important labor leader and a socialist who was probably the most important socialist in American history. Mm-hmm. I guess some would argue that they don't feel socialism is very important to the history of America, but in fact it is.
Well, you know, I have to say Ellen Fitzpatrick, again, at the University of New Hampshire, I guess what you historians would say to each other is, yeah, let's do it again in 50 years and see.
I think we did a reasonably good job, but the differences are what are always very interesting to look at.
It's one of the world's greatest parlor games.
It is. It's fun.
Ellen, thanks so much.
Glad to do it.
Oh, yeah, and by the way, it's inevitable. Elvis Presley, 66.
Where's Marilyn?
Where's Marilyn? I'm all shook up. Yeah, yeah. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, my hands are shaking and my knees are weak. I can't seem to stand on my own two feet. Who do you think? Okay, hit it, boys. No, you haven't time-tripped back to the 40s, to one of the staples of corporate America, the office typing pool. This is the Boston Typewriter Orchestra, five men of letters, if you will, who take their typing seriously, sort of. Here now's Chris Ballman, caught up with the group at a recent Boston performance.
The Boston Typewriter Orchestra is one of the opening acts this night at a rock and roll bar called Great Scott. And a small, somewhat puzzled audience watches as five men take the stage, then sit down in front of an array of old-fashioned typewriters of various sizes and shapes and shades and start to peck away.
Wait, stop. I'm out of tune.
Oh, man. Not again. Sweet. Wait, a G? Get it right.
The Boston Typewriter Orchestra is all about having fun, by poking fun, not only at themselves, but also at office culture, past and present. Band members all dress in white starched shirts and retro ties, and often as they play, they engage in water cooler banter about the time management consultants the bosses brought in, the lousy pay and vacations, and the kind of stuff many young guys usually talk about.
Hey, Jim, have you seen that new chick in accounting?
Yeah.
Always talking about.
She's fine.
The orchestra formed about 2 years ago. Yeah. No one is quite sure why or how. Alex Holdman says he got involved because banging away at the keys is, for him at least, one part percussive party and one part therapy.
I'm kind of the sort of person that always has a little internal rhythm going, so I'm sitting at a desk and I'm rapping on the desk or clicking something, clicking my pen, usually just kind of pissing off everyone around me. And, you know, this is my natural outlet for those sort of urges, that I get to come here at night and tap on the typewriters and maybe reduce a little bit the amount that I annoy the people around me during the day.
The Boston Typewriter Orchestra plays only its own songs, and since their instruments are by nature atonal, rhythm is, well, key. Holman says the band meets every few weeks to practice, which usually starts out with someone randomly tapping away. Others join in, and soon, out of the chaos, comes composition.
Normally we sit down and like start with one beat and extemporize off that beat and go a little crazy with it, and it turns into a big old mess. And then we go back and find what parts of that big old mess kind of sounded good, and, you know, go back and reinforce those and try and pull something out of the chaos that actually sounds pretty good.
Holman and bandmate Tom Shimizu say each member has a specific role to play on stage and a specific instrument. For Holman, it's the tenor typewriter, a Smith Corona.
It's kind of one of the portable secretary models that has a really, really light key sound to it and a really, really fast key response. You can do a lot of quick melody on top. And then we have a couple bass typewriters running around that are, you know, big models designed never to be moved. But yeah, then you lay into the shift key and, you know, the earth moves.
There's a lot of S's and Z's because the S and Z keys are next to the shift keys, which is the bass key for every typewriter. So
kind of disturbing, actually, how good you get it. You know, figuring out the different delicate tones you can get out of a typewriter. I mean, I feel I'm going to be specialized in this, and, you know, the band is going to break up, and I'll be useless elsewhere.
The Boston Typewriter Orchestra will release its first CD in the spring. In the meantime, there's talk of bringing in a few of those big old vintage 1970 IBM Selectrics, plugging them in and going electric. Hey, it worked for Dylan. Until then, band member Jay O'Grady says it's on to the next gig.
You know, as long as people want to, you know, hear us play, then we'll keep doing it as long as it's fun. And I don't think any of us are going to quit our day jobs. I think all of us have to go to work tomorrow morning.
We wear white collars.
Work like slaves.
We wear white collars.
Work like slaves.
We wear white collars and we work like slaves.
Our story on the Boston Typewriter Orchestra was produced by Chris Ballman. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More useless but fun information from Schott's Almanac is still ahead. That's Here and Now. Here and Now. After a series of extraordinarily successful and more than mildly addictive miscellany books, Ben Schott has a new almanac out. Now, Ben Franklin had Poor Richard's Almanac with its virtues and aphorisms, a January fog means a wet spring. But Ben Schott's almanac will tell you where to find the world's largest concrete banana, or what exactly is a kosher cell phone. And scholar Ben Schott, author of Schott's Almanac 2007, joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
What is it with you and collecting information? We've spoken before, but this is amazing. I mean, for instance, I can see on this one page where, who the youngest bloggers are and what percentage of bloggers are women. And then I flip over here and, the way the Royal Society printer prints visiting cards, you know, the different sizes of cards that they print. Why are you even interested in that?
In the world we live in, where there's such sort of large seismic shifts of sort of politics and state and religion and faith, often it's in the details, it's in the margins, it's in the footnotes, that A, the interest lies, and B, these sort of small details often speak to much larger stories. So I think by sort of concentrating on what you might think is sort of just a detail, actually you learn something about, you know, the wider, larger story.
You know what? I'm going to just open the page, just at something. So here's Nobel Prizes in Science in 2005.
Absolutely.
And those are summed up. And then, of course, next to that, the Ig Nobel Prizes. These are the ones given out by Harvard University students, right?
And the Darwin Awards, which is where each year they select someone who has rather ignominiously removed themselves from the gene pool by some spectacularly stupid stunt that's led to their death.
Oh, dear. I see the dubious honor in 2005 went to Marco, the 55-year-old Croatian man who wanted to clean his chimney, lacked the broom, and improvised a makeshift device by attaching a brush to a chain and requiring a heavy object to weigh it down, chose a what?
Just a hand grenade, which I have to say is bold for your last move. Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's a terrible story. But now, does something like that just catch your eye and then you make the category?
Absolutely. I mean, quite often while you're researching a story, you come across other things. So give you an example. We have two pages on the Oscars. Now, obviously, the Oscars happen every year. So we have all the Oscars, who's won them, obviously. We then have quotes of the year because, you know, the different quotes, Jon Stewart talking about Bjork and whether mm-hmm. she or not was shot by Dick Cheney. And the quotes often give you a flavour. Then we have this year something about what each celebrity, which dress she wore by which designer down the red carpet. Because the year is not just about the major seismic event. It's often, you know, about sort of small textual details that allow you a way into a story, like the Oscars.
You know, a good example of that, how just some silly thing might, you know, be more revealing, is on page 201. And this is actually a sort of a little essay on cell phones, texting, etc. And the first line just pulls me right in. Very Orthodox Jews are forbidden from using new generation cell phones because they offer access to the worldly temptations. However, in 2006, there was a company that made a kosher cell?
Absolutely. And this is approved by the religious authorities. And what it does is it bans, or rather it prohibits, things like film access, internet access, text messaging and photos. And also these so-called kosher mobiles have special tariffs. So phoning other kosher mobiles is cheaper. Now, what's interesting, I think, is two facts. A, you have, you know, a very ancient Talmudic authorities who are dealing with modern interventions and modern inventions. But what's also interesting is that these kosher phones, which are all about protecting the pious from worldly temptations, are also being embraced by the Islamic faith because they too fear such sort of encroachments of the modern world.
But speaking of which, you write about how cell phones are being used to observe Sharia law.
Absolutely. There are calls to prayer. There are mobile phones with compasses now, so you can find the direction in which to pray to Mecca. Quite a lot of the debates at the moment are about faith, and that's why there is a section which we deal with faith, because I think, you know, although it might seem archaic, and it might actually be a sort of a nod back to the ecclesiastical almanacs of the past, actually, it's an increasingly important part of the postmodern world.
Well, and just sticking with cell phones and faith, you write that observant Muslims can avoid the rule of having to say, I divorce you three times in order to divorce someone.
Absolutely, by sending three text messages saying the same thing.
Something.
I mean, the idea of being dumped by text message is one thing. The idea of being divorced is quite something else.
How do you get the information? Is it true? I thought I read somewhere that you use the internet a lot, but for your first few books, you used the library almost exclusively. So what has changed?
Call me old-fashioned. I do. I mean, I love a library. I have to say, with the almanac, with Schott's almanac, there is a sense that the library just isn't good enough because events happen so quickly. And so I do use the internet a lot. But, and there's an important caveat here, the internet, I mean, when people say I look at the internet, they think you type something into Google or Wikipedia. And, for example, you know, I did an analysis of George Bush's use of certain words like terrorism, Iran, Iraq, freedom, oil, this kind of thing, in all of his State of the Union addresses. Now, you wouldn't just go to Google and type that in any more than you'd go out into the street and say, how many times did George Bush say Iran in his last State of the Union? It would be a preposterous thing to do. So when you use the internet, it's like a faster cab to the library. You would go to the White House press room and you download the PDF and you'd read the PDF of the speech. Now, pre-internet, that would have been a phone call. You had to get it faxed over. You'd have to maybe go to, you know, a library that stocked, you know, government records. It would be a pain. So actually, the internet doesn't necessarily change where you go for information. It just makes it a faster journey to the same information you would have got.
You know, speaking of information, the New York Times recently ran an op chart that you pulled together, 5 years of consequences since September 11th. All kinds of, you know, the kinds of fun information that you were known for pulling together, from word frequency in the State of the Union addresses to top Google News searches. Jessica Simpson, I still am not quite sure who she is. She topped it in 2005. When you put something like that together and you stand back, or you put this book together and you stand back, what does it say about us?
I think increasingly, looking at Schott's Almanac for 2006, 2007, there's the sense that there are sort of big trends. And say the op chart after 9/11, it was 5 years on, and you know, no one in America can be unaware of that. And I think what's very interesting for me is actually the Danish cartoon crisis, because I think there's a sense that the Western liberal democracies, in inverted commas, and which America obviously would like to be the primary player, sort of have to hear their tone of voice. It's almost a sense that looking at the almanac and looking at the year, it's a way of saying we are odd, we are curious, and we assume, so if you go to the Danish cartoon crisis, we assume that our love, our inalienable, self-evident right to free speech is the only one. But of course it comes across and it hits absolutely up against the inalienable, self-evident right to have your faith respected. And I think increasingly, and that's what you get all the way through the almanac, actually, this is the trend that I see in science with, say, stem cell research, or, you know, abortion and contraception, the big, you know, gay marriage, these big sort of moral issues. It's about sort of realizing that everybody has a tone of voice, even if you can't hear it. You think I'm obviously sound English, I think you sound American, but you don't hear your voice. And I think we probably in the West have to hear our voice a bit more, because our voice is heard loudly in other parts of the world.
And this is one way to do it, by looking at the year assembled by Ben Schott in Schott's Almanac 2007. It's just out in the U.S. And to find out more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Ben, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
He's a man with a plan, got a counterfeit dollar in his hand.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugertz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our intern, Katie Falsigno. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Must be seen, there's no doubt, he's the coolest one with the biggest smile. He's Mr. Know-It-All. When you tell him he's living fast, he will say, what do you know?
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.